You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network.
Hello, welcome to the New World Pictures Podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. And welcome to our series, Corman Graduates, where we take a look at the chronological filmography of a director who went through the Corman system. And welcome to our third episode on director Jack Hill. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
Always.
And Erica.
Not a guest.
No. And joining us is a guest. He is a director of American Grindhouse and That Guy, Dick Miller, and hundreds of DVD and Blu-ray extras for companies like Criterion, Arrow, Kino, Shout, Vinegar Syndrome, so much more. We are so thrilled to have Elijah Drenner on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Round of applause. Thank you.
We'll drop in a round of applause sound.
Yeah.
So we'll make it
long.
Very long. Very loud.
It'll be obnoxiously long. It'll go on for 3 minutes and everybody'll be like, is the show actually going to continue? By the way,
calm down, everybody. Calm down. All right, let's get to the podcast. All right, just calm down, everybody.
I absolutely love this movie, by the way. This is just
well, you got the good Blu-ray. Good. Thank you so much. No one likes the slipcover, but hey, they'll get over it. We put a free movie on there.
What matters is the movie, is the film, and it's just absolutely terrific.
Thank you.
So, and I got to thank you for all of the special features and extras that you have done throughout your career, because, you know, in prepping just for this podcast, if not for any other episode we've ever done, I'm realizing you were responsible for so many of those extras that we have utilized for our episodes. So, I mean, this is such a thrill for us.
I'm glad somebody got use out of them. Truly, because you'd make these things. I mean, I'm not just like, my job is to make bullet points for the back of a disc.
Right.
That's my job.
Right.
Deliver the bullet points, give it a name, and then it's done. So I really have no idea once it's out there if people watch them. I mean, I know people do because I see reviews and stuff, but that's it.
It's because of those bullet points that we have bought so many Blu-rays.
Good.
So truly, thank you.
Yeah.
Good.
A lot of your work is right behind us. So.
This is
active.
Oh my gosh.
This is active. It's live.
This loft space that I'm looking at above me right now is chock full of everything I've done plus more. So it's a lot of stuff.
That's awesome. I mean, it's amazing. We have been graciously invited to at least adorn one. We're one bullet point on a disc, mm-hmm. So we're very proud of that.
Four.
The great land of small.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Canadian,
the CIP.
Our episode on that was utilized by them and is it's an extra commentary track.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Well. Those guys do great work. They're one of my favorite partner labels. So
yeah, they're fantastic, very nice guys, and obviously awesome. They put us on one of their discs, so they're basically our favorite label in the world.
They're amazing.
But we're going to talk about an interesting period in Jack Hill's career, because we're going to talk about the New World portion of his career, and we're going to talk about, you could call the New World portion or also the Women in Prison portion. It depends on how you want to talk about it. But I want to ask you, when was the first time that you met Jack Hill?
First time I met him, well, it goes back further. When I was in film school, early 2000s.
In Minnesota.
In Minnesota, MCTC, now just Minneapolis City College, I think is what they call it. Mm. I was making my film and I wanted to show, I liked Spider Baby a lot. I was a big fan of Spider Baby. I had that DVD, that old Image Snapcase DVD. And Jack was foolish enough to put his email address in the liner notes. So I emailed him and asked permission to use a clip of Spider Baby on television. And he agreed. So we stayed in contact. I never finished film school and I wanted to just make a documentary about Jack Hill. So I was traveling out to Los Angeles, shooting interviews with him for a documentary that I never really finished, but it was sort of like a warm up for the stuff that I would eventually do. And this, even though the documentary never happened, it turned into producing the Spider Baby stuff and getting the director's cut out. And I knew, yes, that one right there. Yes, I knew that Jack had basically gotten the rights back to the negative. He was barred from it. So I had this bright idea. It's like, Jack, you know, you can, there's a myth that Spider Baby is public domain. It actually isn't. But the previous edition was. So I said, Jack, reinstate your cut scene from that old DVD, put it back in the movie, call it your director's cut. You can copyright it and then hire me to do the extras because I know everybody. He says, deal. So that's how it started.
Wow.
And
that is cool.
So, I mean, it probably would have happened eventually anyway, but I had met Jack many times before that. So I couldn't even really tell you. It was probably, I'm going to say 2001, 2002.
Okay. And so I'm holding the Spider-Baby Arrow Blu-ray.
Yeah.
In which you do a few things, but my favorite thing is that you take Jack back to the original location.
Correct.
Where they shot the movie, which is in Highland Park.
Correct.
And still there, I believe.
Oh, yeah, still there. I mean, you can see it on the, well, it was called the Gold Line. I don't know what they call it now, which goes from downtown to Pasadena. But if you mm-hmm. look to your left at the Highland Park station, if you're going north, you'll see the little tower. That's the house.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Also, the house from Hots, by the way. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie. That's the same house.
Wow.
If you look at the poster for Hots, that's the Mary house on the poster.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's the house is the Mary house. Hots, written by...
Eric Cafaro was a co-writer on it.
Yes, who did Too Hot to Handle for New Correct. World Pictures. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Which I also did the commentary for.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Which we did an episode on it.
So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've totally lost contact with Sherry. I have no idea how she is or where she is, if she is.
She had a website up at the time we did our episode. And I was like, I'll get into contact with her. And now that website is down. So yeah. I don't know. We would love to talk with her too, because
Sherry's awesome. And I mean, if you heard the commentary, I haven't heard it, but it's like, she's mind like a steel trap and mm-hmm. hilarious. And anyway, Sherry's amazing.
She really is. She's a really, really interesting, person, and she's had quite a wild career but only one film with New World, and she had an extensive exploitation career. So, you know.
Yeah, her husband made all those movies, and I think those negatives are just lost. I think they're lost films. I think, those, you know, whatever tape masters exist, that's it probably, unless someone finds them.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of them are available, like the Internet Archive, some of the early, the Ginger, and some of the early stuff that she did with her husband. So,
yep.
But we, just in our last episode, where we left off, we talked about Mondo Keyhole, which you did the commentary with Jack on.
Okay, that's right. You know, that's a different cut of the movie, too. And I've been trying to figure out, you know, where those rights lie. That copy, the one that's out there, is not sort of the Jack Hill version. There's an alternate version of the movie that's Jack's. Hmm. And you can tell it mostly by the dream sequences and the camera work in it, where Jack's like you running the camera, and that version, they're both weird, but the Jack's version's just a little bit stranger. And I even think that had like an old VHS like Mondo Keyhole label a title over something else. Like I feel like it was like an afterthought. I think because that's because it was the original title was The Worst Crime of All. I think
right. It has, I believe that might have that title on there.
Okay. Yeah. I can't remember all the details, but yeah, that's not Jack's version.
But I think Psychotronica is actually putting this out now on Blu-ray, and they're going to separately put out the raw ones.
Okay.
So
double your money, double your fun.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I'm glad they're putting it out on Blu-ray. I'm excited for that. Because I like the movie. I just wish they would find the other version.
Sure. Sure. No. And so we talked about this version that was there with L, and we also talked about Pit Stop, and that's where we left off, where Jack had sort of come back to Corman, and he ends up staying with Corman and New World to make two more movies. But he has sort of a little side trip that he does, which is a series of four films that Jack co-directed, let's just say, that star Boris Karloff. Some of them, Fear Chamber, Isle of the Snake People, House of Evil, and Incredible Invasion. Essentially, what he did is he shot these movies with Boris Karloff, but just the Boris Karloff sections. Karloff had made a deal with Mexican producer Luis Enrique Vergara to shoot all these movies back to back. But because of Karloff's emphysema, he was unable to travel to Mexico. So Jack just shot all of his scenes in Los Angeles with sets that his father built, which Jack's father would often build a lot of the sets that we'll talk about. He built the birdcage, for instance. Right. Jack told Callum Waddell, he said, quote, Karloff was very kind, very patient, very happy to be working because he was dying and virtually unemployable. Nobody could get insurance for him, so this Mexican guy just took a chance on him, and he was taking a pretty big risk because Boris had to breathe oxygen and he was in a wheelchair on set. And Jack had to write a lot of scripts. There was only one script written. So Jack came up with a bunch of other ideas. He pitched to him. Incredible Invasion was actually written by Carl Schanzer, who was in Spider Baby and Bloodbath, which we talked about in our first episode. He was supposed to go to Mexico to shoot the rest, Jack, but he doesn't end up doing that. And Vergara ended up directing the rest in ways that Jack was extremely unhappy about. And at the time of Callum's book, he had only seen two of them. He had not even seen all four of them. He just wouldn't even watch them. Have you seen them at all?
I've seen Fear Chamber. I've seen Isle of the Snake, but they're largely unwatchable. And I couldn't tell you, you know, which one was which.
Yeah.
Honestly, I just can't. I mean, it's Boris on a set.
Yep. 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 To me, they're like, when I was in college, my buddies and I, we would have parties and you would just put movies on the TV on silent, and you would just have them play in the background, and people would be like, "What's that weird movie?" And those are his Karloff movies. They're at least weird things to have on in the background, but they to sit down and actually watch them, they're rough.
Yes. Best viewed in a noisy bar with the sound off.
Correct. Correct.
That explains college.
that actually, in a weird way, though, leads Jack back to Corman and New World, which he had already just been working with him for Pit Stop. But, and again, this is really because of your special feature that you did on the Women in Cages collection.
Mm-hmm.
Because he comes across a script for The Big Dollhouse.
Correct.
And that is the original one, which is written by James Gordon White. Mm-hmm. And James Gordon White had a movie that was being shot at that same studio that he's shooting all the Boris Karloff stuff.
Correct.
And Corman is just now setting up New World. They had done Student Nurses and Angels Die Hard in 1970. And he and Larry Woolner, who he started New World with, Larry Woolner was a trio of Woolner brothers who had drive-in theaters in Louisiana. And they... Larry came on board for at least the first year or so of New World, and he's the one that said you should do nurses movies. And he also was like, how about women in prison movies? Because I think Corman actually released, or he had shot one early on in the 50s that the Woolners had put out. So they decided to do that, thought that would be profitable, mainly because 99 Women, the Jess Franco film, had come out and had seen some success, and they thought they could do better than that. And thought, let's make a women in prison movie. And Jack had come across James Gordon White's script and said, hey, how about this then? And brought it to Corman.
And it was really just the title. That was the only thing that, you know, it's not the act, you know, whatever James wrote was not what they actually end up filming at all.
Right. That's right. That's right. And James Gordon White had done, like, by the way, he had done some movies for AIP in the late 60s. He'd done like two female biker movies, Hell's yeah. Bells and the Miniskirt Mob.
Yep.
But what's interesting is that they take his script, and at the time Corman has to run off to Ireland. He's going to shoot Von Richthofen and Brown. So he puts Stephanie Rothman, her husband Charles, and Woolner sort of in charge of New World while he's off shooting his penultimate directorial feature. And what's interesting is that I actually read in the LA Times, 1970, there was an article that said that Lenny Stack had been set by New World Pictures' Larry Woolner to score The Big Dollhouse, the James Gordon White screenplay, to be filmed next year with Corman directing.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because Jack had brought the script to him, but all of a sudden they're talking about Corman directing. And in fact, Corman was going to direct the movie in Puerto Rico, where he had directed a trio of films, Last Woman on Earth and a couple other movies. But those plans obviously changed. But Corman was going to direct, which I think is really interesting because I don't think I've ever heard Jack talk about the fact that Corman was going to direct the movie. He certainly talked about the changes that happened to the script and the input by Stephanie Rothman, of course, that he's talked about. But I've never heard him talk about Corman directing, which I think was the original plan. Also, Lenny Stack, by the way, does not do the music at all as well. He does the music for CC and Company in 1970. That's what he ends up doing. He does not do this. Instead, Hall Daniels does the music and writes Longtime Woman, which is the song that Pam Grier sings. But yeah, to go back to it, your feature from Manila with Love, I don't know anywhere in print that I've seen that James Gordon White got the screenplay to Jack because they were in that same studio.
Correct. Correct. And I think they just met. It was just totally circumstantial. They just met and they never had any real contact before or after that movie. So.
Yeah, he doesn't write anything else for him. He doesn't really write anything else for New World. And in fact, they end up putting the guy who wrote Student Nurses, Don Spencer, he's the one who ends up rewriting it. And of course, Jack ends up totally rewriting Big Dollhouse once they're actually in the Philippines.
Right.
But in between all of this happening, because Corman's off in Ireland, Jack is also off somewhere else because Corman was approached to make another movie, which is Icon Groupie or I Am a Groupie.
Wir brauchen nur zu einer Band zu gehen. Die Jungs sagen uns da Bescheid und vielleicht können wir bei denen noch übernachten.
Aber nur übernachten. Schlafen werde ich mit keinem.
By this guy, Erwin Dietrich, who comes to Corman and says, hey, do you want to direct this movie? He had a basically licensed the movie from Corman before, so that's how he had had any association with him. And he wants him to direct the movie. He says, no, I won't, but I have this guy named Jack Hill, and he'll gladly direct this movie for you. And you've seen this movie, right, Elijah?
Oh yeah, that's the best of the ones you're talking about. For a variety, it's not good, but it's the best. I don't know how much of the camera work is Jack's, but Jack was a good cameraman, and I think a lot of the documentary sort of verite style of it all is really just electric. I think it's a lot of fun to watch. The lead is, certainly easy on the eyeballs. That doesn't hurt. And yeah, it's no masterpiece, but I don't know how much of it is Jack's and how much of it is Irwin's. So it's hard to say.
Yeah, he doesn't last very long, only a couple weeks, I think, in Zurich, where he and Jane go over there. Jane Schaefer, his girlfriend and producer. And he does say this in Callum's book. He says, so the title was going to be I, a Groupie, and Roger asked me if I wanted to do it. I said that I would love to do it because the Big Dollhouse was going to have to wait until he got back from his travels. So Dietrich agreed, and we made a contract that specified the picture would be shot in English so that Roger could release it. And I don't remember the other details. Dietrich pretty much ignored everything anyway. So Dietrich also gets him like a lead actress, Ingrid Steiger,
Yeah,
who
that's the one. Yep.
she doesn't speak any English.
No.
And he basically doesn't have a script. As soon as Jack shows up, he's like thinking he has some time to set up the movie. And he's like, no, you have to start shooting. So he had no script. He has an actress who didn't speak English. He shoots for a couple of weeks. He gets fired. Dietrich takes over. The experience is something that Jack was very unhappy about.
Yes. Very unhappy. I mean, it was contractually, you're supposed to have an actress that spoke English and she didn't. So, I mean, it was right off the bat, the odds were stacked against him. So he was really, I think set up to fail. And I don't think Erwin C. D Dietrich really had any plan other than to just, he was sort of peripheral to the adult film industry. I think he was just, God only knows what Erwin C. Dietrich had up his sleeve, but he says something in his interview on the German disc. He talks about and I think this is in Callum's book too, but it's the extra with Irwin basically throws Jack under the bus in a way that was totally untrue, at least from what I can gather, because I mean, we all write our own histories, right? But I don't really know why Jack would. It's not like it's this crowning achievement. If he was fired, he probably would have said so. And that's a totally different story. So
he had a vested interest in the movie. And that's the other thing, too, why he wouldn't want to.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, exactly.
He was going to make money on it. And the reason why he didn't quit with all these things going that way was that he would have ruined the contract. And he had, if the movie had gotten picked up and then Corman had released it, he would have stood to make money on it.
Exactly. Exactly.
And as it turns out, they do release the movie overseas, and Dietrich puts it out as Roger Corman Presents, which then Corman sues him over and makes a bunch of money.
Wins,
makes money, which, of course, is money that Jack never sees.
That Jack doesn't get. Yeah, exactly.
So this is what he's doing, basically, leading up to Big Dollhouse.
Women. Locked behind walls of concrete and steel, guarded by barbed wire and guns in a tropical hell. They call it the Big Dollhouse.
And he's like not sure about going to the Philippines. He's never been there. Of course, it's the first movie that New World shot in the Philippines. So they were not sure of the situation there either.
Yeah, well, I think Corman was relying on John Ashley at that point, who had been making a lot of those films. He was the next Pat living there. And this was, you know, with Eddie Romero, this was the Filipino film industry was just starting. So, you know, it was someone was going to go there. It might as well be Roger Corman to make these movies.
Yeah. They had shot like all the Blood Island movies and Creature with the Blue Hand and a couple other things that New World kind of releases around that time.
Yep.
But this is their first venture in the Philippines.
Correct.
And Hill decides to do this movie because essentially, as he says in his commentary, his career was at a total low point.
Yep.
Four movies with Boris Karloff, which eventually gets taken from him. He doesn't know what even happens to him at that point in time. He goes over to Zurich. That turns into a disaster. He's basically like, all right, let's just do this Women in Prison movie, I guess.
Yeah, he had nothing to lose. I mean, his first movie was unreleased. His second film was barely released. So, yeah, he was he had nothing to lose, and that's probably what made a great product.
Yeah, so these two movies, I'm sure you've seen many, many times, but
yes.
Did you see them before you ever met Jack?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I'd seen pretty much all of Jack's work before I met him. I mean, I'm sure I did, but I don't know exactly when. But I mean, I talked to him at length about all of his movies, you know, in the early 2000s. And, you know, I still have all the tapes. I've just never done anything with them.
It's a kind of amazing that you got to see, you've seen all of his stuff at that point in the 2000s. Because, I mean, his career had sort of stalled out until the 90s when Tarantino put out Switchblade Sisters through Rolling Thunder. And I think that's when I sort of, at that point in time, got introduced to him. I think I'd seen one of his other movies. I think I'd seen Coffee, but I didn't associate that with him. I associated that with Pam Grier, But Switchblade Sisters, I was like, who's this guy? You know?
Yeah. And it was probably around 2000 that Switchblade Sisters was theatrically re-released. I'm guessing maybe like late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. But then at that same time was when the Image Laserdisc of Spider-Baby came out, which was a subsequent like Anchor Bay VHS tape. And I had that. And then I got the DVD. So yeah, I've had every home video format of Spider Baby since 97.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And then you get to take him to the old house. That had to have been a very cool experience.
He took me there. I mean, we had gone there before, so we knew what we were doing, but
okay.
That was not our first time there, but I've been back many times since. And the people there are very, very friendly who actually own it.
Okay. That's good. I was wondering because in that featurette, you guys kind of just go around the house, but don't.
Oh yeah.
Go
well,
inside.
we told them we were coming. So we didn't show up unannounced. We got their permission and I've since been inside the house. They actually had a tour of the house many years ago. I went with Rodney Asher and his wife, Rodney lives nearby there. So we went, but yeah, so they never shot inside the house of Spider-Man. It was all set. But to actually see the inside was pretty cool.
Does it? It doesn't look anything like the house. I can't think
of it. No.
Yeah.
No. But it looks exactly like the house from Hots because they shot Spider-Man.
That's how you have to see the inside. You got to watch Hots.
But I was like, hey, I was like, that is the inside of the house. Amazing.
So Elijah, what is your feeling on women in prison movies?
I love them. I'm so glad you brought me here because really, you know, and I was thinking about this earlier. It's like, you know, yeah, with 99 women being sort of like, hey, we can finally show skin in a women in prison movie. It's like we've come to this point. You know, there's a long history of women in prison movies all the way back to, you know, Warner Brothers in the 30s, and they're all great. I mean, I love all of them, and they all borrow from one another. I mean, one of the earliest movies I ever saw was Reform School Girls. Very young, very impressionable, and very wrong of me to see that movie. But that uses the same, it uses, you know, the kitten from Caged, which Jack does in Big Dollhouse, whether that was intentional or not. But I don't know, it's a wonderful subgenre of film. I love it.
It's interesting how and I'm not going to say that I'm an aficionado of it, but seeing these, of course, and talking about these on our podcast, and seeing a bunch of other ones, it just feels like it's one that you think is easy to get right, but people can easily get it very wrong.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, the best women in prison movie was made by a gay man, Reform School Girls. I mean, it's just like, it's the greatest women. He's like, he totally understood how to make that movie. No shade on Jack, because I love Big Dollhouse and Big Birdcage.
Of course.
Jack, you know, but Jack, he knew the conventions. He was playing with it. I mean, the gay prison guards. I mean, come on.
And, you know, much like Reform School Girls, when he does Birdcage, he's sort of saying, well, the subgenre has really taken off, so I'm going to just kind of make fun of it, which, of course, is what Tom DeSimone has been doing, because he did a couple women in prison movies leading up to Reform School Girls.
Yeah, but they weren't good. But he's like, he rolled up his sleeves and did it right.
Yes, mm-hmm. That's very true. He did what he wanted to do.
Right. And that's what makes, you know, through a queer lens, those movies are really what they always should have been, frankly.
And he nails the camp in Reform School Girls.
100%. I don't know
if well.
Will Danning knew it was funny, but it's very...
right.
That's a really good point, actually, because she feel the way she portrays the character is, this is a very serious movie.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm a very serious part of this movie.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Pat Ass is just, you know, tearing everything apart. I mean,
just chewing the scenery, just going for it.
I know.
What a career she could have had. I mean, she's amazing in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Going to Big Dollhouse.
Yes.
What's interesting to even revisit it, because this is one of the first movies we covered on our podcast, and it was great to revisit. Judith Brown is like the lead character, but she's very quickly is overturned. Because it becomes Pam Grier's movie until it's not.
Yes.
Right.
and it's kind of fascinating that, I mean, Judith Brown's not any name either. Like there was really no name actors in this movie, really.
Well, I mean, you know, historically, Pat Waddell was probably the biggest star because she was on Petticoat Junction.
Right.
If you call that a star. But she was probably the only one. And she was she was a supporting role. So,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's and Bobby, of course, Bobby Collins had done other New World Pictures. Maybe this was her first, but she became
you know, very yeah. She was yes. very well. She and Pam immediately go from this to Women in Cages,
right?
And Roberta does a couple of other ones as well afterwards. But yeah, this would have been her first. It's still very early on in New World's history. I mean, looking back through it, I was like, oh right, they'd done a couple Angel movies.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk to Roger. in You're From Manila with Love, he lists this as the second movie New World's put out. And I was like, well, that's not true. But I suppose for purposes of that interview, he's like, who cares about the rest?
Well, I think it was New World proper movie that they made. That is what I believe it was. And so there, I don't know quite the history of those two biker movies that led up to, but you know, talk about someone who's written his own history. Roger has written his own history from the get-go. And I don't know if Elle got into this too with his career during that, that Western that everybody that for Columbia that he got fired on.
She did talk about that. Yeah.
That to me is, you know, the catalyst for F you guys, I'm going to make my own movies, but he, some other thing. He had some other agenda with AIP and he wouldn't talk about The Time to Kill at all. But I think that's as much of an excuse to just give the middle finger to Hollywood and do it yourself. So that's, you know, those biker films, I guess, is it Angel?
Angels Die Hard Angel? Is the first movie they released, then Student Teachers. And then they did the second Angel movie with Barbara Bury Peters.
Bury Me an Angel, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, with Barbara Peters directing. Mm-hmm. And so he'd picked up some movies to release.
Yeah.
So this is very early on, certainly in terms of a movie that they produced with their own money. But he produced Angels Die Hard and Student Teachers. Those are all movies that he had made off the money he had made from AIP.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I guess I don't know the exact stories, but you know, whatever, Raj, you're in charge.
But but that was kind of how he was. You're totally right. He was such a salesman, and he was always going to just talk about things in a positive light.
Yes.
I mean, he wrote a book about how he made all these movies and he didn't lose any money, but he had lost money.
Yes, of course.
He had lost money. That was so the book.
Well,
the name
over
of the
long
incorrect.
Run, he didn't.
Over the long run, yeah. At the time he lost money, but like Intruder, he didn't make money. You know, he there was a bunch of movies that he had done that he didn't do well. But that was Roger. He would sell everything as if he was had been a huge success.
Yep.
It's interesting though that there's a couple bits of this movie too that also like play into Birdcage as well. Like there's some tropes in here that he plays again. He turns the hose on the ladies in both films.
Well, you have to have that. You have to have a closing scene. So that's one. Has to be there.
Right. He is forced into Dollhouse to have a mud fighting scene. That's Larry Woolner sort of telling him he's got to have that.
Yeah.
There's the torture, which he does more in Big Dollhouse and only a little bit in Birdcage, but they took parts of James Gordon White's script and did put that into Women in Cages. And that one's certainly a lot more torture focused.
Yes.
And then there's all the Ilsa movies that like follow and sort of took, you know, that. So they took the torture stuff and ran with it.
Yes, they did.
to put it lightly.
Yeah.
To make torture fun.
Yeah. They were like,
a lighthearted romp.
They only did a little torture. Let's really go for it. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. Of course, he throws in these tropes, but and like you said, they had these things had been in these movies, but at the same time, those women in prison movies weren't very popular at the time. And he sort of sets this whole template out just with Big Dollhouse.
Well, I think it became a genre really after Big Dollhouse because 99 Women, you know, it preceded it. But then what Corman did with all of those movies after the fact was what created, you know, I don't think anyone was clamoring for a women in prison movie consciously in, you know, the 30s, 40s and 50s. It was just a drama that they could make, a good B picture. It's a one location, multiple actors. It's like, it was just kind of, it was an economic thing to make, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm just guessing, but like, that's just, you know, if you look at just, they're all the same. They're all the same.
Yeah.
But well, I mean, it becomes the Big Dollhouse made for what, $125,000, it made like $10 million. I think when I'd run the numbers in 2019, when we talked about it, it was like a 129% profit on this.
Wow.
Which works out great financially for Roger and goes back to him not losing a dime. But it certainly, whether it was the substance of the movie or the timing, it really, it found an audience, and that really catapulted that genre.
Well, and I think part of the audience that it found was an urban audience with Pam Grier.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, I think that's something, I couldn't tell you what those numbers are exactly. I don't think it really has, you know, what those numbers would be, but mm-hmm. she's what made those movies popular yeah. and successful.
For sure.
Yeah, she's such a star, like right out of the gate. I mean, this mm-hmm. is her first movie, and it's so clear she's the star. And you can tell, I'm not sure if Jack does this deliberately, but he really focuses on her for like an hour and makes her the big part of the movie. But of course, the script is going a different direction from Jack, yeah. and she ends up getting killed by one of the girls that she sort of takes care of in the prison, who's addicted to drugs. And so then she's out, and you're like, oh, darn, because we really we're really invested in her. That's
yeah,
you know, he and even once he makes Big Birdcage, she's still sort of not ancillary, but she's still more of a supporting character to Anitra Ford. She's just the revolutionary, and yeah. and I think she's still sprinkled in well, but she still doesn't take as big a part. But obviously, once Jack leaves New World, he focuses very closely on Pam, and that's where his career focuses on. But
yes,
this movie, though, Big Dollhouse, did make domestically, it made $3 million. I think it's $150,000. And MGM did foreign, and it makes $4 million foreign as well.
Wow.
So this is 1971 money.
So yeah, in 2019, I'd run the numbers that adjusted for inflation, and because I had a 10 million, both domestic and international, it would be about 63.5 million in 2019 dollars.
Yeah, and he, I think Roger said he had this quote in Chris Nashawaty's book, which I'm going to mess up, but he basically said he wasn't too sure about Big Dollhouse, because it had a lot of violence and he wasn't sure about that. And then once it released and it made $3 million, he was like, well, let's do another one.
Yeah. Those scruples are still standing, right? The girls are still over there, right? Let's do it again.
Yeah. His scruples faded away very, very quickly.
I had, interestingly enough, though, and just how this movie still resonates today. After we had talked about this movie many years ago, I had one of my very good friends say that the Big Dollhouse was the first Blu-ray he ever purchased.
Wow.
And huh. It still stands by, like, one of his all-time favorite movies. Now, that I don't know, that might speak a lot to him, but I mean, it just kind of shows.
Who are your friends, Mark?
Maybe we should cut this out. But but I
just more than one.
Friends with prison guards, and you know,
a lot of people in prison guard industry. But
people
no,
in prison.
I think it just still speaks to a movie that still can capture an audience and still resonates with people today.
Agreed, 100%. I mean, I watched it again, and it's still great. I mean, it's a great movie.
Mm-hmm. You know, Pit Stop, when we talked about it in our last episode, that was really Jack sort of making an art film out of, you know, stock car racing.
Mm-hmm.
And this one still feels a little bit, and you know, for me, at least personally, I kind of like Dollhouse a bit more than Birdcage. As much as I like Birdcage, I like them both. Mm-hmm. But Dollhouse, to me, even though I don't think it was the movie that Jack wanted to make, but there's something about him being given, he always rose to the challenge when he was given a movie that maybe he wouldn't have wanted to make. But he was just going to go out and give it his all, no matter what it was.
Well, and I think it's just the casting, too. It's the casting. That's what makes the movie magic. And it's not just Pam. It's Judy Brown. It's Bobby Collins. It's Pat Waddell. It's Brooke Mills. It's everybody in that movie. They're all, you know, they're all very great in it. And it's that ensemble, I think, that really makes it so, you know, so wonderful.
And Sid Haig as well.
Oh yeah, Sid, of course. Of course, Sid. But yeah, of course. But you go to women in prison movie for the women, not Sid
Though
Haig.
now you know why Ryan's there. Mark's there because he loves prison guards. Ryan's there for Sid
wait till you see this movie that Sid Haig's so good in. Also, there's a lot of naked women in it, but that's,
Yeah, exactly.
It also introduced us to Lambanog, which at the time I thought was a made-up thing just for the movie.
What was that? Lumbanog? Yeah.
Lambanog is the it's the it's what they're drinking out of those jugs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yes, I know what you're talking about
It's
now.
like
Yeah.
a sugarcane derived
Yes.
vodka.
It's made from like a coconut. It's made
Oh,
out of like,
coconut.
yeah, it's like sort of a kind of like a coconut moonshine is
That's good.
essentially what it
That's
is.
accurate. That's
Well,
accurate.
when we covered the movie, I found a bottle of Lambanog and we drank it while we discussed it. And
Ooh.
it is powerful stuff. It's powerful stuff, is all I can say.
I've never had it, so I'm going to take your word for it.
This is not Lambanog. This is just water.
Yeah. We're drinking water tonight,
We're
so
all
just let
addicted
you know.
to
Yeah. We're taking a momentary break from it just for this. And then we'll get back to our Lambanog as soon as this is over. But there's a couple other things that are happening in these movies too. There's a couple things that he kind of reuses. There's a element of in Dollhouse when Sid Haig says, "I'm not gonna rape one of the women, they're gonna rape me," which
Right.
then sort of happens later in the movie and also happens in Birdcage.
Right. Well, I mean, Jack, I can't speak to, for Jack, obviously, but he's his sexual violence that happens in his movies is very cinematic. It's about the optics rather than the actual act, I think. I think of even like Mondo Keyhole, It's that's what it's about. That's the original title is The Worst Crime of All, referring to sexual assault. And he has to put these in for marketing reasons, and he does it the best way he possibly can. And it's not, to me, it's not sleazy or gross. And then he flips it on its head in Birdcage when the women assault the gay prison guard and Ted Abbraccio squats on his face to shut him up. I mean, that's Jack. There's a lot of, I was thinking about Jack and his, Jack was, I think, a hedonist in his days. I think he admits to it probably at some point, but there's a lot of sitting in his movies. You think in Spider Baby when she crawls on Uncle Peter's lap. When you think of even in Coffee when she pours the champagne on King Charles and goes down on his lap, and you think there's even a similar sexual act in Swinging Cheerleaders where she lifts up his whatever thing that hippie was wearing and goes down him underneath his. There's a lot of lap stuff in Jack's movie that I have always kind of caught on to. And I just think he likes that. I don't know. But it's something there's a sensuality to it.
For
That's all I
sure.
can say. I don't know what it is, but I'm speculating.
It's true. And there's another element of to that end, Roberta Collins doll and Dollhouse is saying she really misses a man more than anything. And that's echoed by Candace Roman
Yes.
and Birdcage, who's
They're all sex starved.
yeah.
Well, those two are anyway.
But I think there's an element that the Jack is also very keenly aware, and why I think he's actually such a he goes back to Corman and why he's such an effective director for Corman, because he understood what needed to be exploited with, I think, without much handholding by Roger.
Yes. I think, he was, yeah, he knew what he was signing up for, and he wasn't gonna fight for it or fight against it, I should say. I think. I don't think Jack was very inhibited with the performers. He didn't, he knew that, they've all told me it's like, when they had to show their bodies, it's like he's like, okay, I get it, I get it, I get it. Okay, put your clothes back on now, because that's what they had to do it to see, it was part of the gig. But when it came to being on set, I just think he knew he knew how to give audiences what they wanted. He just did.
Yeah, he had like a real sense of that and a sense of fun. I think though Dollhouse is certainly less comedic, it still has a he can't help himself but add humor to his movies.
Well, and I think it's part of the casting too. I think he likes it. It's who's to say that, Birdcage would have been as funny without Teta or Candace or Sid or Diaz. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, look, all he had to do was deliver the poster. That's all he had to do. Just deliver the poster. Make sure something happens every 20 minutes. Give me the shower scene. Give me the hosing scene. Give me these things. I need these things checked off from the box. Put in whatever subtext you want, whether it be political or whatever.
And Jack said that he had not seen 99 Women at the time that he did Big Dollhouse. But like you said, there's been a history. Do you think he was as aware of the history and was calling on that, or just
No,
simply?
I don't think so. I don't think people were aware of. I can't say it was. It's not like we're talking about women in prison movies now. I mean, there was not 100 years of cinema. People, there were no rep programmings.
Right.
There was no women in prison box set that you could pick up in a Walmart $5 bin. That didn't exist. So I can't say that Jack was consciously aware, but he might have been. His father worked for Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers made a lot of those. But my guess is probably not.
Yeah, because I just think he but he I mean, I think he sets the standard and everyone copies him like crazy after Dollhouse, and and he does these unique things. I think that little, I don't know where he got it this from, but just the fact that in Dollhouse, when the women are in trouble, they get put into those little cages and they're sort of strung up and they have to have their arms like lifted above their heads. All these things are like, who, where did that come from? I
I
mean,
think that was my guess is that's the sort of thing that was probably imposed on him by like someone like Woolner, where you had to like again just check that box.
yeah.
Just check that box. I mean, 99 Women is very much like that. There's a lot of that in there.
Yeah.
And it's for prurient audiences. I mean, it just was. Let's just call it for what it is.
But like I said, he still throws humor in there. He has that big food fight scene in Big Dollhouse, which is clearly something he's having just having fun with, which, by the way,
But
I
you
want.
have to have the food fight scene for the hosing scene.
Right.
True.
Right.
It's all the setup.
It's all setting
Yeah.
up. Which, but in rewatching it too, by the way, I just saw that they were, she pours her coffee all over the food, and I'm like, look, if you're gonna pour coffee all over my food, I'm definitely still gonna eat it, so I can still get that coffee.
Yeah,
I was looking at
exactly.
that like, all right, well, if I have to get my coffee by eating food, I'll that's this that's what I'll do because I need that coffee. He mixes in all these exploitative elements. He goes off. He's supposed to make. He actually almost makes a movie for MGM
Yes.
after Big Dollhouse becomes such a huge success, and he gets an agent, which he didn't always have.
Correct.
And so he gets this agent, and the agent's like, he goes in, pitches a movie to MGM, and then he's got this agent. He runs off, and he takes a couple month vacation. At this point, I have to assume that he's no longer with Jane, but because he doesn't go with Jane on this vacation, but who knows? I don't know what their situation was like, so I don't know.
I think Jack, always had, like I said, he understood how to deliver certain things in that way. I mean, Jack got around. I mean, it's like, he famously his joke with, he's married now to Elke, but he had two women in East and West Germany. It's like he had the wall in between. They were never going to meet. They were never going to meet each other. It was perfect. So yeah, I mean, I'm sure he was off with someone else.
And he comes back from his vacation and his agent's holding out for more money, and they MGM basically said, yeah, they didn't, they said, well, we call your bluff, we're not going to make that movie, and best of luck. So he goes back to Corman to make Dollhouse, which, or sorry, Birdcage,
Birdcage.
which he was gonna make anyway. I think that he was set up to do that regardless. But I like that he comes back and says, I'm going to have a lot more fun. The difference between Doll, and I'd love to hear everyone's thoughts on this, but to me, Dollhouse feels like the movie he must make, so he does the things he must and throws in some of what he would like. And Birdcage is more the movie that I think he would like to make. This is more his taste, what Jack would like to do, even though he still has to do the things you have to do in a women in prison movie. But this is the movie he would more like to make.
I think you're probably right, and it's opened up a lot more too. They're not stuck inside that set that they were. They were able to really, really get more bang for their buck in terms of the locales. Like the rice paddy fields and just all the vistas and everything like that. It opens up a lot, right? I think it's a better made movie for sure. I mean, I kind of like them both equally. It's hard to choose one over the other, but no, I think you're probably right. Do we know if he had more money for this? I guess I never knew if he had more money
I
for this.
don't, it's still Corman and it's still early. So if he had more money, it's got to be like maybe another 100,000,
Yeah.
maybe.
I mean, my guess is probably not, but it just feels like maybe there was, this is again just speculative, that there was more recon. He kind of found things in between, the two movies, maybe. And discovered where he could shoot this other one once he got back. I don't know. You'd have to ask him. But yeah, I think too, with Birdcage, why I think it's better is, it's the cross-cutting between the two storylines. And I just think that's inherently always more exciting in any kind of movie when there's two sort of, but they're coming to a head at some point, and you've got those two storylines bouncing back and forth. It's just, I don't know. It's easier to watch and more fun, actually. More fun to watch.
Yes. I would say though that that part of me, it's interesting you say that. For me, I see that and I agree with you. I just also see like the revolutionary part and dealing with Sid and Pam also feels like he's kind of like, I really would love to do something outside of this genre.
Yeah.
You know?
Or he's just padding it out, maybe in some ways. Like if he had to pad it out, at least it's, Jack was, I don't think he had any sort of political agenda with his movies at all. I just think he really did just, it's easy for a viewer to impose on it, and that's his job. If that's what you saw, then I did my job. But no, I don't think he actually had any sort of secret liberal agenda. I mean, his politics vary wildly from movie to movie, between, the hippies and swinging cheerleaders. And the one thing that is all the way through is powerful women. That's what he likes. And I think this is perhaps, well, maybe Switchblade Sisters, but like those are the ones that like he really just lets those women just rip loose, and they loved it. They fucking loved it.
Was there anything to you watching? You've seen these movies many times, but watching them again for this, was there anything that struck that you saw differently, or you kind of saw for the first time, or it?
Well, just kind of like I said about the cross cutting back and forth, I think that was what I realized that was something that I like the two storylines, I should say. There's different action happening in Dollhouse as well, but it's the weird thing about the mysterious warden is sort of like the other story going on in that movie, even though I was less invested in that one, I guess. But I really like Sid and Pam as a couple too. And they're fun to watch together. And that whole scene where the guys come to him about the revolution and say, "Hey, we want to throw this revolution." It's like, and Sid's is like, yeah. Oh yeah, the French Revolution. Yeah, I've heard of that. Started in France. Yeah. It's like just like he, I don't know. It's that's what I got more out of a Big Birdcage. And I think Pam is better used in it as well. And not to say that she isn't as good in Dollhouse. But you can see the beginnings of Coffee and Foxy Brown with Birdcage. Yep.
He's starting to learn how to utilize Pam Grier
Yes.
in Birdcage, where she was an unknown quantity in Dollhouse.
Well, I mean, she's got one of her best lines, which I cannot repeat,
Nope.
in Birdcage. I mean, fuck yeah, that's a movie star.
And it was her line.
I know.
She came up with that line. Jack is very, said I could never have written that, I think in Dollhouse she's already like she just comes into that movie like a huge star. I it She just showed up on arrival as a movie star, but certainly I agree with you. In Birdcage, he's just utilizing her so much better.
Plus, in Birdcage, they introduce a strategy for avoiding being captured where you cover yourself in tallow, and then no one can tackle you. And mm-hmm. I had never considered that before, mm-hmm. but if I'm ever in that situation, I'm just gonna strip naked, cover myself in tallow, and know yeah. that I've that gives me a fighting chance.
Yeah, please don't
get slippery.
That was the best response you could have heard. Very good.
You know what, Ed, listen, watching it again, I thought, you know, no one's tried that in a zombie movie. Like, what yeah, a per right. like mm. I mean, what a perfect, no one can grab you.
Yeah,
yeah, but it's gonna make you smell so much more delicious.
Yeah, that's true. Especially, so. Well, yeah, you're right. And tastier. Yeah, you're mm-hmm. right.
Yeah.
It's like yeah. seasoning your body for them.
Right. Because, I mean, you will slip at some point. You will slip.
Right.
Did you, what, when you did the whole background on this for the DVD, like, what are you looking for when you're putting together one of those special features?
I knew the stories roughly. And, you know, the elephant in the room is always Pam Grier because she doesn't do these interviews. And, you know, as much as I admire and respect her, I think she doesn't really care for this early work. She's not one to talk about this stuff. And I mean, and even her association with Jack is not something that she had a career in mind, and yeah. there's no fault in that. She had a career in mind, but she's not someone to sort of get the band back together, so to speak, right? She's not going to do that. In fact, Jack has told me this more than once. I don't know if it's been publicly said, but Jack was brought to the Fox, or sorry, the Jackie Brown set. Did you ever hear this story? He was brought to the set to do a little PR. Quentin, you know, had him come down, and Pam didn't come out of her trailer. Never showed up. She just stood him up.
Mm.
So, I mean, that right there says everything. So she just had a career in mind. Mm. And I think that's the story that I would always like to get. I just want to get Pam's side of the story. And I think, you know, everybody, at least in my experience, not everybody, a lot of the actors and even Jane, it's like people, you know, they were a team making these movies, and there was a lot of conflict. There was a lot of drama going on behind the scenes. Jane sort of alludes to it. I've learned a lot since then. It was a crazy time for them. And I think a lot of wounded egos. I think Pat Waddell thought she was going to sing the theme song originally, and then she was mad because Pam did. It's like stuff like that.
Yeah.
But even more so, I remember Roberta Collins, she was the wild child. She got everybody into trouble all the time. And, she told me that they had, Ike and Tina Turner were touring, and they went and partied with them. You know, they went to a show, and they probably was like, I said, wow. I said, Bobby, you partied with Ike and Tina? She says, yeah, well, Ike. So, yeah, I mean, she was just always in Bobby. Bobby was great. I really miss her. She passed away.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize when I watched that piece for the disc, I didn't realize that she had died before we made that. So these things just sort of blend together, but, because I had also interviewed her for something that hadn't been used yet, which came out after. So it was very a confusing time. Wait, I interviewed her for The Roommates, which Pat Waddell was also in. Pat Waddell doesn't talk about these movies. And I guess, am I answering your question? Like, what?
Yeah,
what was
it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So I'm just always looking for the stories, I guess. That's what I'm always looking for, is like this, and try to put some sort of oral history really of what this thing was, and make sure they, you know, contradict one another. And that's sort of hard to do when you're trying to tell one story about the making of. You can't really, you can, but it's better in, I think, in written form. But it'd be really great to have a real good oral history of people's points of view of that movie. Judy Brown, obviously, she's in it and she's wonderful. And
she's been willing to speak of it. I mean, you have like an interview with her as well.
Yeah. And CJ and Teta, obviously, for Bird. Well, that was the big, trying to get actors for Big Birdcage. I hadn't tapped that yet. So I got CJ, Candace, I should say. She goes by CJ.
Mm-hmm.
And Teta, and Anitra Ford. And getting Anitra was hard because she, I mean, she still doesn't like respond to me. But like, you know, she did the interview. And getting her was crucial because she's kind of the Judy Brown from Dollhouse, you know, she's mm-hmm. the catalyst of the story.
Yeah. I would say she's the absolute lead of Birdcage. I mean, yeah. She really is the lead. Whereas I think Judith Brown, who's great, and I think she's really good in Dollhouse, but as soon as she gets to the prison, she sort of becomes like, she just goes to the role, you player. Know, yeah, really? She, yeah. Well, she becomes under the protection of Pam Grier and anyone else that will mm-hmm. protect her or take care of her. And,
yeah.
and she sort of becomes a secondary character.
Yep.
Which yeah. though she's our sort of way in.
Yes, exactly.
Which is kind of interesting because in Women in Cages, it's sort of the same thing. Like the character that sort of brings us into the prison, who's like the newbie, sort of them get sidelined as we deal with all the other characters yes. that are in the prison. It's
yes, exactly. Yeah, I just try to get the story. I mean, I still want to get the stories. These discs are never really done. In my mind, it's like it just has a deadline, so I finally have to stop.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why I'm saying, you know, and I'm thanking you for these, because these are kind of the documents that we have about these movies in many ways. Like you know, as our podcast, we're trying to interview a lot of these people as well, and we've talked to a bunch of people that have worked on these movies, but like, it's, you know, it's not easy. And there's not a lot out there, particularly the 70s Roger Corman stuff. And though yeah. Corman has done a lot of interviews, he sort of tells his side of the story.
Right. Right.
You know,
I mean, you know, these, you know, unfortunately, you know, Teta has passed away. I learned that recently.
That's too bad.
You know, people, you know, they're not around. I mean, these yeah. movies are old and yeah. people don't live for it. It's, yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, you're doing these interviews, it's I think they're always better years later. They just are. And I watched that from Manila with Love again, and I was surprised at how it actually got better as it went along, which usually doesn't happen. And I think it's because of Teta and CJ and Anitra getting into Big Birdcage. But I mean, yeah, those, they were, Jack was just so good at casting too.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing, is that Jack really had an eye for getting the right people together. And I don't think he was casting these people together. You know, it's like you get people together, you have no idea what it's going to be like. Mm-hmm. You're just hoping. But I think the cast of Big Birdcage is also another reason why I like that one more. I think, Teta is hilarious and Anitra is great. It's like, it's just a wonderful, wonderful cast.
Yeah, it's interesting. Jack says, you know, in print, and he says in the commentary, he says that the cast got along really well in Dollhouse, but you're saying there's also some drama that happened behind the scenes. So maybe that was a bit of.
I mean, they got along. Yeah. But there were camps. There just were. I mean, it just happens. But no, I think even Judy says so. It's like what was happening behind the scenes was infinitely more interesting than what happened on camera. I mean, there was a unwanted pregnancy at some point with one of the cast members, and there was a big thing, you know, with having to get it aboard. It was gnarly. I mean, they were in a third world country, and there were these young, hot Americans, I mean, you know, like partying with Ike and Tina, well, Ike going, you know, partying with, you know, stuff like that, you know, but they were treated like royalty too, I believe, when they, so they could get anywhere they wanted to. They had just carte blanche, and I don't think they worked long hours and they had a lot of time to do what they were doing. So, but I don't think Pam Grier was doing any of that stuff. I think she had her career in mind. I'm mm-hmm. guessing, but I don't think she was really getting into that trouble. And, mm-hmm. and when I got all the photos from Candace for Birdcage, I mean, Pam's not in them. Pam's not hanging out. She's yeah. not part of the crowd.
From what everyone said, she was off on her own, setting her line. She was focused and, you know.
She had a career in mind.
Absolutely. And even when Sid talks about being in Jackie Brown and that being a surprise, and she was really happy, but he said they hadn't seen each other in 27 years.
Yeah, and probably not after that.
Right. And they had made so many movies together.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I looked at, I bought Pam's book. And I was like, oh, let's see what she says about some of these old movies. Doesn't talk about them.
No. It was just stepping. These are just stepping stones. And it's not. She's who she is. We love her.
Yep. Totally. Totally
respect her for it. But yeah, just a different point of view. And you find that a lot with actors, frankly. It's very common. I honestly, like, people talk to me about interviewing. Usually my least favorite people to interview are actors, because they're on a set, they're playing a character. It's just them. They're just focused on what they're doing. They usually, I mean, I'm speaking generally, but there are some actors I've interviewed, and I'm not, you know, criticizing them for
being who
they are, but you know, they're just, their job is to recite lines and feel emotions and convey those emotions and make a scene real. And that's what they're doing. And they very often don't have a lot of introspective thought after the fact. They're on to the mm-hmm. next.
Right.
That's always been my experience, especially when you're doing something about a feeling in a movie they made 30 years ago.
Right. They're also going to often be concentrating on what they're doing. And so when they're doing their thing, then they don't know about all the other things that might be happening, you know?
100%. So
the other thing that, and I feel like this happens a lot with New World movies. We talked to RJ Kaiser, who edited Battle Beyond the Stars. But one thing that always sticks with me since he said it, because he talked about Battle Beyond the Stars, and he said that movie is a Rashomon event, and that everyone has a story. Yeah. That is their story. Yeah. And it may be different than everyone else's.
And they're all right.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly. And I have to think that that's something that you encounter constantly.
Well, 100%. You're just trying to tell a story, and you know, you can't, like I say, it's like there's just a deadline where I have to sort of settle on, this is who we have. And you're trying to tell one story with multiple stories. And when you're doing like a multi interview piece, sometimes they're all on the same page, and sometimes there's an outlier somewhere, which doesn't really fit. But yeah, I feel like, I don't know. We have these ideas of what we think these actors and people who made these movies are going to feel, and they just don't. They have their own agendas, they have their own plans, they're their own beings, really. And you know, I was so spoiled with Jack too, by the way. I was so spoiled by Jack being like the first, you know, person I reached out to and ever did an interview with on camera. And you know, just, I'm sure, just bumbled my way through it. Jack was always so patient and taught me a lot too. Even just incidentally, just, you know, palling around. And you know, I was really spoiled by Jack. And the first really bad interview I ever had was with Roberta Collins. And it's why she's used so sparingly in that, because it was just a bad interview. And I didn't know how to handle it and like turn it around. But she was one of those actors who just didn't have a lot of experience. It's like, which one? Oh yeah, that was fun. Yeah, great time. Next. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, you always want a little more. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at that thing again, she's even trying to just like, you know, talk about how fun it was to have a food fight. That's right. That's, it's like, but okay. tell me more. It's like she just didn't have that.
Yeah.
Just didn't have that, that introspective thought. She was just having fun, making a movie, on to the next.
That is something we come across a lot too with interviews, where people either maybe don't remember, or maybe, I don't know whether it's they don't recall or they don't want to say what they recall.
I think, and, yeah, hard to say, but yeah, I find at this point in a lot of people's lives, if they're not in the industry, they will just say, mm-hmm. they'll just tell you the story. I mean, a lot of people do, in my experience, and you choose to use it or not.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you want someone to come across well. And so I never want to use an interview that makes them, it's like, you know what? I'm going to take that part out for you. I'm going to take.
Yeah, oh yes.
So yeah, of course. So yeah, you're always just trying to make people look and sound good.
But the thing that's important, and why I think, you know, why you've done such a great job, particularly such a great service to so many people, but just to make it about us for this podcast, is that when you watch New World movies, you need context. Mm-hmm. You don't watch these movies and then go, well, okay, I don't have any questions. No questions. I'm that's good. I don't have any questions. Like, how did that come about? You know?
Well, yeah. And you also just want, I mean, it just enhances the experience, right? That's
totally,
all.
Totally.
It's like they are good on their own, but they're much better when you sort of get a story to go along with it.
Totally.
And honestly, you know, podcast culture has replaced the bonus features, you know, cause we're not, you know, you're not restricted to clip usage, you're not restricted to music licensing or any sort of space bandwidth on a disc. So yeah, it's like, this is, I keep telling people, it's like, you know, film podcasts are the new director's commentaries. They just are, and that's, I'm fine with that.
Oh my God, are you crying, Max? He's crying tears of joy. This might have been the kindest thing anyone has ever said to him.
I think that's, I can understand what you're saying. I don't know if there's anything that we've done that's on par with what you've done.
No,
but you know,
well, I just, agree. Well, I'm just speaking, you know, in general. It's like, I think people.
Okay, so yes, you're not talking about it.
But this is an example. But this is an example of it where you're not restricted to having that disc in your hand. You can.
Right.
Pop it on your earbuds and walk around and get, you know, very much the same version, mm-hmm. same package. So that's what I'm referring to. You're not
sure.
You know,
sure.
And that's fine. I'm very happy that this stuff, it's weird that, you know, it's almost been like 20 years of doing this sort of stuff, which is bizarre to me. And you know, I've got a lot of hard drives. I'm just happy that people are carrying these things around for so many years. And I still have a lot of the original tapes for a lot of things. So, yeah, I mean, it's just, I love the history. And I think it's important to get it out there. And I'm very happy that you guys sort of carry the torch. And if it clues someone in on sort of ordering off menu and listening to that commentary track or watching that bullet point, I mean, I'm all in. I mean, it's right there. You know, we're spoiled in terms of media and content now. It's overwhelming. And so yeah. I'm very happy that this stuff is still out there and that people find it.
So I guess I have a question that's separate from the focus of this podcast, which is you talked about trying to get a good story, and ultimately you have a deadline, so you at some point say, well, I'm just going to take what I have and make the best story I can out of it.
Mm-hmm.
What was a special feature though that you felt you really got what you wanted, the one that you look back and say, that was exactly like, I got everything I wanted for that one, and I got to tell the story that I wanted to tell?
Well, that never happens. But what I will say,
or the closest to it.
Here's the thing. But here's what I have learned, though. Lower your expectations. Assume everyone's going to say no, and just be happy with what you get, and then have fun with what you got. Mm-hmm. Rarely do things actually exceed my expectations, and I think the only job that ever went above and beyond and was far greater and actually was a really great story was the Six String Samurai piece that we did for that 4K UHD for Vinegar City. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny because it's, and I even told, you know, I work for Vinegar Syndrome now, but I was freelancing for them at that point. And I said, you know, they called me or whatever and said, we're doing this. And it's like, I remember sitting or standing at my standing desk, editing, doing something for Vinegar Syndrome. This was years before the job came up. And I said, 16 Samurai should be out in Blu-ray and Vinegar Syndrome should do it. Back to my work. And then it happened. So that was the one serendipitous thing about it. But then it was made during COVID, and that was sort of like the low point of bonus features, you know, the COVID idios, I call them, the all the, you know, the Zoom stuff. Mm-hmm. So what we did was, Lance, the director, I won't spend too much time talking about this because it's not related to but Lance, the director, was going to be doing these interviews, and he was going to be directing them remotely, and he was going to start shooting right now. It's like, well, that's not, none of this will ever cut together. People's heads talking to cameras, cutting back. That is the worst idea I've heard yet. So I got on the phone with Lance and I said, you've got to shoot yourself shooting the interview, because the only way we can make this thing work is if we actually incorporate the process of this into the making of the documentary, where you are going back and interviewing people, and this process is part of the story. And it was triple the amount of terabytes. It was so much effing footage because it was covered from all these different angles. But I'm getting to your answer here, Mark, but it was something that exceeded my expectations in that I was doing way more than we needed to do, but we were actually getting a good story out of it, which surprised me. Mm. I think that was where I kind of get to, like, no, I never really get what I want. I get surprised by things. And so if I sort of leave myself open to being surprised by something, that's the best thing. I try to stay willfully, not ignorant, but realistic about what's going to happen. You know, we're dealing with people shooting things that I'm not always there for. And, you know, someone's going to look like shit. Something's going to look bad, and it's just going to be what it is. And you just accept it and you move on. But the Six String Samurai thing, working with Lance too, because I really love the movie. But getting all those interviews the way we did exceeded my expectations. It's one of my favorite things, and working with Lance was a lot of fun. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. I was pointing because I have the disc.
Well, you should.
Yeah. So I was like, that's exciting. You know, we've had some people we've interviewed that have just been a fountain of information, and you're like, wow. And then you've had people that we've been so excited, and they're very buttoned up, and you're like, huh, okay. And they're not maybe in other interviews you've seen. So you're like, was it me, or was it, you know, it's interesting how it all, you know, it's a tough.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. You just never, and it's weird too. I mean, you go to someone's house, you set up a camera, and you talk to them about something. It's weird. It's a weird thing to do. I mean, this is, you know, obviously not the same thing, but it's weird when you enter someone's space. You don't know what happened before you got in. There's just a weird scene sometimes, and who knows? I mean, I've had some of the strangest experiences of my life going into people's trailers or homes to interview them, and it's just strange. Always.
And the thing about Jack that I think is great is that he does have his stories. And I think and he's pretty good. Like, his stories are pretty consistent. He's been a pretty, you know, he's a good interview because he's got a lot pretty well locked in.
Yes. Yes. Jack. I mean, Jack's like unstoppable, man. This man, he's got the mind of a steel trap. You know, his mother lived to be over 100, you know. Jack, we're going to have Jack for a long time. I mean, I just know it. And he's so on it, man. Just good genes, good living. I love him. I haven't talked to him in Elka for a long time. I saw them down in when they were Now they moved back to Charlotte, but I was down there interviewing him for Swinging Cheerleaders Arrow disc. That was the last time I saw him. So yeah, I mean, Jack's great. He's great. I mean, like I said, I was spoiled from the beginning with someone.
Yeah. I think the only thing I've heard him do get wrong is that in Callum's book, he keeps saying it's Barney Woolner, but it's Larry Woolner. But Barney is Larry's brother. So he's not, I mean, I get where he pulls that, but so
I get things wrong all the time too.
But he rarely does. So it was kind of interesting to come across
entire interview. I've just been pulling things out of my.
Oh no. No, but one thing that we've talked about with Callum and we've talked about even with Elle, so I'd love to get your perspective as well, is that there still is that element though, that with him and Stephanie Rothman, he's had a beef with her that has he talked to you about that? Is that something that still exists for him?
I don't know, you know, whatever happened happened. You know, it's not an uncommon thing in the entertainment industry, whatever. I don't even remember what it was exactly.
Well, because Foreman put Stephanie and her husband in charge and Larry in terms of New World stuff.
Yeah.
They started trying to develop the Big Dollhouse script, and they sat down with him and tried to come up with ideas and see how they could move things. And then they just came at an impasse. They saw the movie in two different ways. So, so they didn't want to do his ideas, and he felt felt like Stephanie was trying to impose her will on the movie. And then Corman had asked her if she wanted to direct it, and Stephanie has come out and said she was like, I by no means wanted to direct that movie. She directs a movie somewhat like it in Terminal Island, but she was like, I was not interested in making Big Dollhouse in any stretch. But I think Jack thought that she was trying to take his job, and so he was very sort of upset about that. I think this is all stuff that could have been, but it could have been solved by Roger clearing that up, because I think it's a little bit of, he kind of left her in charge and probably didn't tell Jack. But like I said, I think Corman was thinking he might direct Big Dollhouse. So I don't know how much Jack knows that. So
who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all just speculative.
Sure.
And I don't know the story. You know, I've since met Stephanie, and she's very nice, but she's also cagey. And I think she's cagey in terms of the way that she has been sort of, I guess, villainized in some of these stories about her early career with Corman and, you know, stuff with Dollhouse. And it's, the stories have not included her side of the story. So right. I think that's where she's kind of, why she was kind of sketchy when I just, you know, talked to her after a screening of Student Nurses. And I was respectful. And, you know, in terms of doing the job of a historian or writing an essay or whatever, it's like, yeah, you try to tell the story. And if there's conflicting stories, then you try to just tell the one that you think makes the most sense. And sometimes it's on-screen text. Sometimes it's just letting people say their sides of the story, and that's that. But yeah, that's really all I can say about that.
And so going back to Jack, he moves away from Corman, and he'll go on to the next phase, which is, you know, Coffey and Foxy Brown. But he will come back to Corman yet one more time, which is a movie we kind of love a lot, which is Sorceress. And I know he's not pleased with it. I know he took his name off of it. He didn't get Sid Haig in there to play Pando. It's a huge loss for all of us that he wasn't able to do that. But what we do get is still pretty great and pretty wild. But it ends up being the last movie he directs. I mean, Do you have any idea why you think that was, or why he wasn't able to sort of translate his career beyond that?
I can only give my suspicion. Jack was never someone who had a career in mind, and he's told me that before. He never had a career in mind. With the one, yeah, like he even says, like, the one time I had an agent, he should have had an agent from the beginning if he had a career in mind, right? And leveraging each job as a way of going up and up and up and up. But he always, he didn't have that look at me, aren't I great attitude. And he just wanted to, good idea, let's do it. Good idea, let's do it. He's like, just go down the line. And the only time he really sort of took the reins and like the way Corman did was when he entered the partnership with John Prizer for Swinging Cheerleaders. That made him a lot of money. They tried to do it again with Switchblade Sisters, and that didn't make money. So he was back to Corman for Sorceress. And I think he just chose, he had a different life path after that. He could tell you what that was. I don't think, I know he taught. I think he taught. I think he was teaching film, but he was writing screenplays. He wrote some scripts versus those, like Death Ship or
Death
Death
Ship.
Ships, as he calls it. So he was writing stuff, but
City on Fire.
was that one of them too?
I
Was that one
believe
of the
so.
Canadian movie? Yeah, I guess I've never seen it. So, I guess I don't know. I just don't think he had that career in mind, which is probably why he's so great, right? Honestly. And I'm not, it's like, he doesn't, he just was doing the work and he had that moment. And then he got that moment again in the late 90s and into 2000s with all of his work. And he is who he is because of that. I mean, we're still, that's why you're doing this series. That's why I did what I did. And he probably had a better career that way. Jack and I, he and I have, our birthdays are really close to each other. And so I'm kind of the, I feel like I'm kind of the same way, where it's like, I don't really, I'm not going to make bank, and I'm not going to make my name on just making bonus features, or documentaries about films. It's like, that's not a career. It just isn't. If you think it is, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. And I think Jack was doing things, for reasons that I can relate to, where he just thought it was good, fun ideas. He loved what he was doing. He was lucky to be doing it at a really great time in the industry. And then it stopped.
Well, we were very lucky to have you on this show. Thank you, Elijah. This was really great. And
Yes.
we are just so grateful to you for your time and for coming on the show.
Yes,
Well,
thank
thank
you.
you. Thank you, all of you. Seriously, thank you very much. And now I'm excited to hear the final product.
Do you have anything coming up that you want to tell people about?
Well, it's already been, stuff that's been announced. Well, there were, I was able to reuse some, speaking of American Grindhouse, I was able to, one of our best interviews was with Don Edmonds for the Ilsa movies. And Kino, they've already announced they're doing 4Ks of Ilsa,
They've
and
announced. They love
these,
to announce.
yeah, I know, right? But these are actually happening because I got to master them, saw them, and
That is that's news. That's
so
news.
those are, I let those Don Edmonds, that Don Edmonds piece breathe, and it's spread across two interviews or two discs for each movie, and it's really hilarious going back and watching those interviews. Don was an incredible storyteller, very similar to Jack in a lot of ways. He did have a big career boost in the 80s, but he just wasn't credited. And he talks about that in his interview, what he was doing behind the scenes. So, it was just a really great time to be making movies back then for a certain class of white men. I mean, let's be honest, it just was. It just was. And we're all better for it, frankly. I love discovering new movies from that era that I hadn't seen or passed over, unknowingly. So, but that's the, that's, I mean, I'm literally just finished both of those on the side. So, but just lots of vinegar syndrome stuff. So,
well, that's great to hear, because we, a New World did release one of the Ilsa movies.
That's correct. Which one did they do? It was,
I'm trying to think of the exact name.
Is that the, it's not the Tigers of Siberia one,
yes.
Is it? Is it? Okay, yeah.
Yes.
I, that's not the Jess Franco one either, is it? I don't think, no. See, I've never seen it. I've never seen that one.
Yeah, it's a hard one to track down. And they also released it very minimally, but they still did release it. So that's been one that I've been trying to track down so we could actually talk about it, but it's pretty hard to get. So if they end up actually releasing it, that would make our lives a lot better. And then we'll be using your interview, but to some degree.
Yeah. And it's funny too. It's like, you know, I don't, you know, with the New World, with Shout buying the New World catalog, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's just not out there. You know, there's a lot of things where they just have tape masters or, you know, best available masters.
Student nurses. Where's that?
I know. Well, I think weirdly enough, I feel like Stephanie has that. For some reason, I feel like that's a Stephanie Rothman thing. Because there's a print. There's a new print that I saw it, and she was there for it. Roger didn't spring for that print. Someone else did. I feel like the student nurses is wrapped up with Stephanie. I could be wrong.
Because Shout did like a nurses set, but it's the other four. It's not student nurses. It's the other four.
Yeah. So that's my guess. That's
okay.
But I don't ask me. I don't know those.
Sure. No. Yeah. No. All those things become.
Yeah.
Very...
But there's a lot of stuff that's, you know, Corman would have all of his Showtime remakes too, you know. But I don't know if those things. I don't know if those. They were probably finished on video. I'm guessing they were shot on film, but probably finished. So there's a lot of stuff that is just sort of MIA. But I don't know. It's there's just no shortage of. Wouldn't it be nice if?
Yeah.
Title here was on.
Totally.
Blu-ray. So yeah, it's a. We're never satisfied, are we?
No, I mean, 100%.
No 4K, no sale, right?
That said, everybody pick up that guy, Dick Miller. Check out all the good work that Elijah's done. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank
just a
you
thrill for us.
Much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network, please select the link in the description.
The audio commentary. It's a dying art form, but here at One Track Mind, I, your wonky yet affable host, Ryan Luis Rodriguez, analyze film through the prism of these embryonic forms of podcasting, one audio commentary at a time. Masterpieces, crapsterpieces, live action, animation, cult classics, films literally no one has ever heard of. No track is too small and no track is too big. Join me and my guests from the entertainment world as we keep these features alive every other Tuesday. Hey, who else is going to discuss Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey one week and Citizen Kane the next? Us, that's who. Sure, you have to put up with my voice, but there's a certain give and take in this industry. That's One Track Mind, part of the Someone's Favorite Productions family, and available wherever you get your podcasts.